We're talking today with Robert Meerpol, who is author of the new book, An Execution in the Family, One Son's Journey. Robert, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us why this book and why now?
Well, I'm glad you put it in two different questions because it really is two different issues for me anyway. As the younger son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, everybody wants to know about what it was like to be a child and have your parents arrested when you were three and then executed when you were six, and also given all the decades of revelations that have come out related to the case, some of which point towards their innocence and some of which point towards their guilt, you know, depending upon who you talk to, everybody wants to know, well, what's my take on all of that? And yet, this is really not a book about my parents' case. It's the story of how I survived my childhood. It's a personal memoir. It's what I made of my life. Really, a short way of saying it, it's how I managed to make, I believe, something good come out of a horrendous childhood experience. And I think there are valuable lessons there for people to know. So I wrote the book because the good I made come out of my experience was something called the Rosenberg Fund for Children, which I've been running now since 1990. And so I wrote the book to tell that story and to promote the fund. But then, of course, the question is, why did I write it now? Well, the reason I wrote it now is because June 19th, 2003 was the 50th anniversary of my parents' execution. And that was the publication date of the book, and that meant the book would get a lot more attention than it would have gotten if I wrote it last year or wrote it next year. So the motivation and the timing were actually two separate questions, but they came together.
And the book itself kind of starts from your first memories.
Mm-hmm. It really starts with the last week of my parents' lives when I was six and what that week was like. I decided to start there because I remember enough about that to tell a story. Then I backtracked a little bit because I do have memories before I was six. But then I went forward. The last week of my parents' lives were this emotional roller coaster ride. They were scheduled to die on Thursday, June 18th, and then the Supreme Court refused to review the case. The Supreme Court never reviewed the case. They kept trying. They kept being turned down. Finally, they tried one last time, and the Supreme Court, one of the justices, issued an emergency stay of execution. That turned out to be overridden by a reconvening of the court into special session, which, as far as I know, is the only time it's ever happened. And then they immediately overturned the stay of execution, reinstated the date, and my parents were killed on the 19th. As a six-year-old, of course, I couldn't understand what was going on. But my version of this was that my parents' attorney was asked to give 10 reasons why they shouldn't be killed. And he did. And so the execution was stayed. But then they recalled the court and asked for an 11th reason. And he couldn't. And so they were killed. As a six-year-old, I garbled it. And yet, I think I got the essence of it. And I remember that to this day. And that's really where the book starts, from that point. But then it goes on from there. We were adopted by Abel and Ann Meerpol. Abel Meerpol, the author of the anti-lynching anthem, Strange Fruit, that Billie Holiday popularized, grew up in their home with artists and writers and actors coming in and out. I was very fortunate to be raised by those people. And my name was changed, and we dropped from public sight. And it never was exposed throughout my entire childhood, even though other teenagers knew. Nobody told the wrong person. So for 20 years, me and my brother actually were able to live anonymously, which is, I think, a remarkable story in and of itself. I grew up with this. There were all these people who came forward to support me during the McCarthy period at a time which was very difficult for anybody who'd want to support people who were, even the children of people who were convicted of giving the secret of the atomic bomb to the Soviet Union, who were communists at the height of the McCarthy period. And yet they did come forward. So I grew up in the heart of that community, and I guess I developed an abiding respect for anybody who'd put themselves on the line to make the world a better place. And so that led me to student activism, civil rights, anti-war, college 1960s, new left activity. And ultimately, when the time seemed right in the 1970s to go public with my brother to engage in what we called the reopening effort. But in the meantime, I grew up, I had a family, I believed in the whole struggle of how you become a public person and balance child rearing responsibilities. I felt very strongly that how ironic if I were to abandon or neglect my children in the process of trying to prove that my parents being taken away from me as a child was wrong. So I had to juggle all those things. And in the process, of course, I learned a lot about being a public personality and dealing with the media and all that sort of stuff. And I tried to figure out, really, from the time I was in my early 20s into my early 40s, what to do with my life. I always had this sense that the ordinary was not enough, perhaps because of my childhood. But I kept trying because I didn't really know. I didn't have what was this extraordinary thing that I wanted to do. I couldn't really figure it out. Ultimately, I went to law school when I was in my 30s, and I had this idea. We were involved during the 1970s in filing a lot of lawsuits, and some of these lawsuits had some pretty big numbers, and I had this fantasy about getting a big settlement and starting a foundation in my parents' name. Well, I didn't know what it would do, but that was my fantasy. And then we never won the money anyway, but I went to law school with this idea of developing technical expertise. I still had this dream of starting a foundation. And then I sort of lost my way, ended up in a corporate law firm, gaining technical knowledge that I thought might be useful to realizing my dream of starting this foundation, but not knowing how to get there. And finally, it made me crazy. I mean, to put it bluntly, it was the hardest part of the book to write, to tell that story of essentially breaking down and becoming non-functional. But it was shortly after that that all of a sudden the idea of building a foundation to help children today who are experiencing the kind of thing that I experienced as a child. It popped into my head at 4 a.m. in the morning, several months after I just left the law firm and said, I can't do this anymore. And that set me on a new course. And as I like to say to my kids, it took me till I was 43 to figure out what I was going to do when I grew up, and that was 1990. And in 1990, I founded the Rosenberg Fund for Children, which provides for the educational and emotional needs of the children in this country whose parents have been targeted in the course of their progressive activities. And we now, with the explosion of youth activism, we help youth as well. So that's what I've been doing full-time since 1990. And this book chronicles that. It tells that story. And that's really what it's about. In the meantime, everything's going on in the background. From an author's point of view, you could say what's going on with developments in my parents' case is like a backstory. It continues, and there's an interaction between the two, but it's not the primary story.
Now, when you first had the idea for developing the fund in your parents' name, correct me if I'm wrong, you couldn't have known as much about your parents' situation as you do now. Can you go into more how that kind of came about?
Well, I grew up believing that my parents were innocent. I was absolutely certain that they were totally and completely innocent. This belief was emotional. My brother told me they were innocent. My adoptive parents told me they were innocent. I didn't know anything about my parents' case. I was three at the time. I never forgot who they were. I only started reading about my parents' case, sort of in self-defense as a teenager. It suddenly dawned on me that people were going to ask me questions, and I'd feel pretty stupid if I didn't even know the answers. So then I started reading. I read the trial transcript, which is, it's not that long by trial transcript standards. It's 2,000 pages long, but, you know, the double-spaced, it's like reading a 1,000-page book. I read a couple of books on the case and became intellectually convinced that they were innocent. And then we engaged in this reopening effort for 5 years. We sued under the Freedom of Information Act. We forced the release of hundreds of thousands of documents. And we saw from these documents the way the prosecution witnesses were brought together to iron out discrepancies in their stories, the way the judge collaborated with the prosecution, and the way the scientists in general said, there's no secret of the atomic bomb. Whatever material was involved in the Rosenberg case was of little scientific value. So the scientists, who were essentially apolitical, were saying, we don't know whether Rosenbergs are innocent or guilty, but even if they're guilty, they're not guilty of much. And all this other evidence was showing that the case was a frame-up, that their conviction was orchestrated. So I continued. That even strengthened my belief. Then I went to law school, and at some point it dawned on me that we demonstrated that they'd been framed, but we hadn't proved they'd been innocent, that there's really a difference. You can frame guilty people. If people are guilty but you have no evidence, you invent the evidence to engineer a conviction. How did I know that wasn't the case in my parents' case? I realized, ultimately, I confronted the lawyer, a Freedom of Information Act lawyer, in a meeting, and he admitted to me, he said, well, you know, I never say they're innocent. I just say that they never received a fair trial. And I realized that the situation was subtler than I thought. And so that's where it stood. By the time I started the Rosenberg Fund for Children, I was no longer convinced that I knew they were innocent. They might be. I knew they didn't steal the secret of the atomic bomb. And I think that may have informed some of the Rosenberg Fund for Children's mission. The parents, the targeted activists, the children who we support, their parents are not necessarily innocent. Their parents might have done something. They might have even done something illegal. But the motivation, we have four guidelines. All people have equal worth. People are more important than profits. Society must function within ecologically sustainable limits, and world peace is a necessity. If you get in trouble because you're working to further one or more of those aims, and you have children, your children are potential beneficiaries of our fund. Well, some people who are supporting those kind of things engage in illegal acts. We don't necessarily condone those illegal acts, but that doesn't mean we won't support their children. And the same can be said for my parents. As more material came out in the 1990s, it actually was very contradictory. The material that came out tended, and I go into this in greater detail in the book so that it's a little clearer, but it tended to show that Ethel Rosenberg wasn't a spy of any sort. It tended to show that neither Ethel nor Julius Rosenberg knew much about the secret of the atomic bomb, and they certainly weren't master atomic spies, but also tended to show that Julius Rosenberg might have been involved with a group of young men during World War II trying to help the Soviet Union defeat Hitler by feeding them technical military-industrial information. And, you know, again, the fact that one or the other of my parents might have done something was not in contradiction with the RFC's guidelines, where some of the parents we help do things. And it led me to develop a sort of more subtle and nuanced understanding of my parents, the choices they made, and political activism. You know, one of the things that I think we make a great mistake if we expect purity. If the only people who are worthy of support are those who are saints, those who are absolutely pure, those who don't make mistakes, those who don't do things that we might disagree with sometimes. If those are the only people, you know, who are worthy of support, then nobody's going to get support. And the stage will be bare, be left to those who are the most cynical and the most manipulative. We have to understand that. I have this little mantra I sometimes say to myself, which is, see shades of gray, but act anyway. Don't let this desire for purity. You know, if you want your heroes to be pure, then when you find out that they're not pure, you're going to become disillusioned. Realize that we're all people, and we all have difficult decisions to make, and we all do the best we can. Of course, that doesn't mean that we withhold judgment entirely, but we have to temper our judgment.
Do you think there's a danger even with placing people up on the pedestal of hero?
Well, I think so. I think there is a danger. But the bigger danger is, again, you know, having to say someone is either an angel or a villain. People take heroic actions, and there's nothing wrong with recognizing that. But that doesn't mean that they don't do other things in their daily lives that we might not like. And, of course, you know, all of this resonates today. Unfortunately, 2003, which is another reason why this book is so timely, we look back to 1953, 50 years ago, and I feel that 2003 is a lot closer to 1953 than 1993 was, that even though 10 more years have gone by, we're actually closing the circle, that the fear and hysteria that animated politics, that was anti-communist fear and hysteria, and the fear that they were going to destroy our way of life, and therefore we couldn't let them hide behind the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and national security had to take priority over these things. Well, we're hearing the same thing today. There's a new villain, the international terrorist conspiracy, and I'm not saying it's not real, but we're constantly being told that the only way to protect ourselves is to let civil liberties and constitutional protections take a back seat. So that the equation that's being drawn is security versus freedom. And I think it's a false equation. I think people have to attack the assumption, yes, if we destroy, if we get rid of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, or if we ignore them, or we let conservative judges interpret it away, we'll be less free. But we won't be any safer. Instead, we'll come to fear our security forces. I was listening to, I believe it was an NPR interview not too long ago, with a young woman from Iraq. She was just somebody on the street. I think she'd been a university student. And she said, you know, under Saddam Hussein, we were scared to talk. Now, after his fall, we're scared to walk, that it's become so unsafe. Well, America, Bush is trying to increase our fear of walking, of being out on the street, our fear that we're going to be attacked in one form or another. And what he's trying to do is ram down an agenda which will make us scared to talk. And of course, the objective is to neither be frightened of talking or walking. That has to be our objective. And we should keep that in mind. Yes, there are real threats, but we have to put them in perspective, and we can't let this administration wage war on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights in the name of protecting our freedom, because we'll end up no safer, but we won't be free.
Talk a bit about one of the things that resonates in your book is the concept of them, and you developed that very early on. Do you feel that that's something that is inherent in the children that you're trying to help today?
Well, what I mean by them is, here I was being shipped around to family friends. People in my family, immediate family, were too frightened to take us in. And there was always this talk, you know, we were under attack. Something was happening. My parents had been taken away. And I had this idea that they had taken them away. Who they were, I didn't have a clue, you know. Who these judges were, I didn't know. It was just them. We were frightened of them. You know, I wanted to keep myself beneath their radar. And I think for young children who don't really understand what's going on, there is this generalized anxiety of them. And of course, sometimes it gets translated pretty early into fear of repressive forces. But you grow up with this, and I think the children we help do have a lot of anxieties about that. But there's another kind of them that comes into play. Americans are frightened of them. It's a different them. But that fear is almost as primal. And the thing about fear is, you really don't want to base your motivations on fear. I think that groups of frightened people do stupid things. And if those people have a lot of power, it's not only stupid, they do very dangerous things. So that there's two sides to the coin of them. There's the them that I internalized, and I tried to figure out a way to transform that fear into something that would be beneficial, which is what the Rosenberg Fund for Children is. Well, I think that's one of our challenges, the challenge for America today, to figure out how to transform the cultural fear we now have of them, which the international terrorist conspiracy or whatever you want to call it, into something constructive. Because I think ultimately the only way to get beyond this fear and to move forward instead of spiral into a cycle of violence and response is to figure out a way to make something constructive come of it. And that's a tremendous challenge and may sound, you know, kind of like pie in the sky. But I think we have to have our objectives, where we want to end up in mind, and try to take, you know, even a small step in that direction is a good step.
And obviously the back to the other them, and the big fear to get over is perhaps the current administration and the incredible fear that, as you mentioned before, that they are generating.
The fear takes many forms. It's not just foreign policy or people who look different. It's all of us hiding behind our security systems and our locked doors, the crime rates fall, and yet people are more and more frightened of crime. You get this over and over again, and it's I would go back to Franklin Roosevelt, who said the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Instead, we have an administration that is basing its entire policy on fear, and that in itself is fearful. And of course, you have the USA Patriot Act, which is an abomination, as far as I'm concerned, from a legal perspective. And we have Ashcroft traveling the country trying to build up support for the new Victory Act, which is going to spread it even further. And what's interesting to me about this trip he's taken is he's not going out and speaking to the public in general. He's talking to the chiefs of police. He's talking to the SWAT teams. He's talking to the prosecutors. In other words, he's rallying his troops. And the good thing about that is that there even are people within those ranks. They don't like this either. I mean, just because they're in law enforcement don't mean that, some of them don't believe in constitutional protections and some of them don't believe in American democratic traditions and values. There are people in those agencies who do support those values, and they don't like this act either. And so he's out there rallying the troops, and perhaps I'm being overly optimistic, but I think that's a good sign that he has to do that.
The Patriot Act being another good example mm-hmm. of when you previously said when these people in power do things in fear, it can have really horrible repercussions.
Yeah. One of the things we've seen at the Rosenberg Fund in terms of sort of move in that direction with this question, people have asked us, well, have we had a big growth of beneficiaries with the USA Patriot Act? Has there been a tremendous surge in applications since September 11th? Well, we provide for the children of targeted activists. And, people say, well, what about all these detainees? Well, unfortunately, a lot of the detainees are not activists of any sort. They're just people who were swept up because they had the wrong religion or the wrong color. And I think they deserve support, but it's not part of our project. However, what we have seen with the new laws and the new attitude is anybody who gets arrested, gets involved in civil disobedience. If someone sits down on a street corner and blocks traffic and gets hauled off and given a $50 fine and released, is that person a targeted activist? Do they really fall within the guidelines of the Rosenberg Fund? If they have kids, are we going to start supporting their kids to the tune of $3,000 a year, which is our maximum? We do things like therapy, cultural lessons, summer camp, that sort of stuff, not food, clothing, and shelter. Well, I would argue that I'm not so sure that that person really qualifies. But one of the trends we're seeing is somebody engages in that kind of civil disobedience and gets thrown in jail for 6 months. Now, when that happens, when somebody engaged in a demonstration at the School of Americas in Georgia, they've changed the name now, the torture school that we've been funding and that people commit civil disobedience at, I know of examples where people who are doing the same thing they used to do, and instead of being given a fine and released after a day or maybe 2 days in jail, they're given 6, 8, 9 month prison sentences for these symbolic acts. Well, those people do become targeted activists, and we are seeing an upsurge in applications from people of that sort. And that's making our work a greater challenge. 10 years ago when I started the fund, or 13 years ago, I had to prove to people that there were beneficiaries in the United States. There were potential beneficiaries. There were political prisoners. There were people being targeted. A lot of people, even progressive people, didn't see it. I don't have to do that anymore. That's a real change with the Patriot Act. And the reason the public is willing to go along with it, though I think less and less people are, is because they're frightened. That's the basic fear. I remember in February of this year, when there were, maybe a million of us in New York City on that incredibly cold day, being corralled into these metal areas, separated block by block, not being allowed to, march as we normally were, that when people, lawyers, attorneys, argued in front of before a judge and then the Second Circuit Court of Appeals that this was an abridgment of our constitutional rights to assembly and we should be permitted to march as New York had allowed New Yorkers to march and people coming from all over the country for decades. The ultimate response given by the government was, because of security concerns generated by the September 11th attacks, we have to have these rules. Ultimately, falling back to fear of terrorism, and the judges bought it. So this kind of thing does continue. It is going on, and it does have an impact on the fund. We'll give away $250,000 this year, which I'm very proud of, but you know, it's kind of sad that we need to do that. And I fear the numbers are going up.
How do you find out about the cases that you end up supporting for the Rosenberg Fund for Children? Is that people all coming to you? Do you have an active arm that looks for things?
Well, we're a small organization. There are three of us on staff. And I go out and speak like this, and hopefully people hear about us. But more and more, people reach us through the web. And we have a very simple web address, which is lucky. We got in at the ground floor. So it's www.rfc, that's Rosenberg Fund for Children. So it's www.rfc.org. And that takes you right to our main page. And then there's a million links and even an application that's printable. And you can find out about us and apply in that manner. That's one of the mechanisms. And as I said, my going out and doing things in public is another. And with the 50th anniversary year, we did a big event in New York City. It got a lot of national publicity in June. My book came out. That got a lot of national publicity. All of these things spread the word. But it still surprises me. It's a big and diverse country, and there's a flood of information out there. And I don't think everybody who could benefit from the fund is even aware of it. That's unfortunate. We do our best to correct it.
What final thoughts would you like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think we have an opportunity now. I think bad as things have become in this country, Bush has succeeded in energizing a lot of his opposition. I think there are an awful lot of people out there who are chomping at the bit, who feel that this guy has just gone too far. We want our kids to be able to breathe the air. We want our kids to not grow up to go into military service. We don't want our kids to have the choice of not going to college and being low-paid corporate serfs or going to college and being high-paid corporate serfs. This is not the America we want for the future, and it's clear that this is this guy's agenda. So we look at this and we try to figure out how do we get there. I think we need to take a look at how the right has energized its base. One of the things that I notice about fundamentalism, the religious fundamentalists and the shock troops of the Bushites, because, you know, he's got all this corporate support, but then he's got all these fundamentalist folks out there who support him, not because of the tax cut for the rich, but because he's anti-abortion. He's got certain positions that they're going to go to bat for him about. Well, how have they sustained this movement that involves millions of people? I think it's not only by having fundamentalist politics. It's by having a fundamentalist culture. So if you grow up in that community, you can go to a fundamentalist school. You can go to a fundamentalist church. You can live a fundamentalist life. And yet for those of us in the progressive community, you know, we can have progressive politics, but how do we lead progressive lives? How do we create a progressive culture? Well, some of that is done. And one of the reasons I like coming to Seattle is you get a little bit of a sense of that. But we need to figure out, and that's one of the reasons the Rosenberg Fund for Children channels its funds through progressive camps, to progressive providers, to progressive cultural programs for the benefit of our beneficiaries, but we always channel it through the institution. Both so that we don't have to police the beneficiary, but also so that the institution benefits. This is part of building a progressive infrastructure to enable people to lead progressive lives. And I think that's really important because if it's going to take generations to sustain and to change the United States into a country that we see as more just and equitable, well, then we have to figure out a way to transmit our values from one generation to the next. And I think we need to take a page from the Wrights' book here and figure out how not only to have progressive politics, but lead a progressive life as well. And I think at a time like this, when we feel that we're under attack, but we have an opportunity also to strike back, it's time to think about those things and to put some time and energy and ultimately money and resources into institutions that will support our children and young people so that we don't only take these acts today, but there'll be people around to carry that forward in the future.
We have been talking with Robert Mirapol, who is author of An Execution in the Family, One Son's Journey. Robert, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.